This happens with travel, by the way. I travel all over the world, and there's times when I go to some of the most exotic cities in the world, and I've seen about 700 square feet of it. I was in Hong Kong last year, and for the most time, I was there for a week, and the most I saw was basically a three-mile journey from my hotel to the church, back to the hotel, back to the church, back to the hotel, and all these things. And then finally, they took me up to see this thing called the Peak. The Peak is, if you've ever been to Hong Kong, it's this thing called the Peak where you go up this winding road, and you see this view where you're looking down on the city of Hong Kong, and it's gorgeous. It's like looking at an open treasure chest of just gems. And it was a gorgeous night that night. I saw the Peak. We went back down, and I was so jet-lagged that I was driving down, and my driver, he was a guy who was my host, but he was driving the car. He was talking to me, and he asked me a question. I was so jet-lagged, and in the swaying back and forth of the car, he asked me a question, and I answered him, and I fell asleep in the middle of my answer. I literally said, well, you know, that means because I think my opinion. And then I woke up. And in typical over-polite Asian fashion, he nudged me a little bit, and I said, oh, I'm sorry that I fell asleep. He goes, well, you faded a bit. I hope that doesn't happen this morning. I want to continue our discussion about worldviews. Yesterday's last session was talking about the idea of worldview, and I was speaking about the worldview of Islam and how it answers the four main questions of life that every worldview has to answer. And I want to address secular humanism this morning. We're going in sort of almost a reverse order of the book. I don't know if there's any more of those available. I know that I think we sold out of last night's batch. If there's not more available, I apologize, but there might be some here. If there's not, you can get it, by the way, on Amazon Kindle iBook audio version. I did an audio version of my book, and they had me read it. And if you ever write a book and the guys at Audible say, could you read your own book? Just say no. It's a hard thing to do. anyway... you can get it in those formats. But in the book, I go through secular humanism, pantheism, or the religions of the East, and their Western permutations, and then, of course, Islam on the main worldview questions, the main questions of life and all these things. So we're going in a bit of reverse order. Now we did Islam yesterday. Now we're going back to secular humanism. And if you want to hear about pantheism, well, you have to wait or go online or do whatever else you need to do to get that. But... as I said before, there's four main questions every worldview has to answer. How do we get here, or why? How do we get here? Is it chance? Is it physical forces? Is it by design, by a timeless, spaceless, immensely powerful cause, like God? Then why are we here? Because how you answer the first question, how we got here, will ultimately answer the second question, why are we here? If you think we're here by chance, you're going to answer the second question, why are we here, very differently than someone who believes you're here by design. So how do we get here? Why are we here? Why is the world the way it is? Why is the human condition the way it is? Why do human beings act the way they do? Why are there sufferings? Why is there tsunamis and volcanoes? But why is there also places like Hawaii, for heaven's sake? Or gorgeous buttes and views like here in this state? Why do we have that? And then fourthly, is there a way out of this mess? Is there a better life? Is there something about the beauty that's here and the suffering that eventually is resolved into something that'll be better? Those are the four main questions. Now, as we talk about secular humanism's answer to this, the grand central question of humanism is found right in the name of what humanism is. Humanism is a theologically neutral term. Whether it's atheistic or whatever it might be, or Christian, or it's neutral. Humanism simply means you think human beings are special, that somehow we're different than whales and mushrooms and gibbons. There's something about us that's different. There's a quality about us that every human being has an inherent value, an inherent dignity to us. Humanism values humanity. That doesn't sound like too much of a stretch, given the name. When you look at all the different creedal statements, and humanists, even secular humanists, do have their creedal statements. When you look at their manifestos, and they love manifestos. Oh my goodness, they love manifestos. You look at these things, and they'll tell you what their essential value is, and they'll all say that human beings have an essential value or an essential dignity or a worth that we need to protect and come together on as human beings, despite our shared our differences, come together on a shared value of humanity, and we'll live like Star Trek one day, where we can speak to machines and out pops food and no one we pour. That is a shared value you and I have as Christians, by the way. If you're a Christian here, you share that with your humanist friend. And if you're a humanist who's here, welcome. We'd love that you're here. And we're very glad that you share that same value, that human beings have essential value. But secular humanism believes in that, but says that we don't need God to justify that position. A Christian would say, or a theist would say, that human beings have essential value because God puts that on us. A humanist would say, we don't need God to justify that. We just have value. You ask why? And we'll say, we just do. We have a shared experience, a shared intuition about these things. The question is whether or not it's objectively true. What do I mean by objectively true? Something is objectively true if it does not depend on human opinion. So, for example, the fact that I like vanilla ice cream more than chocolate ice cream is objectively true. The fact that I like it is objectively true. But it's not objectively true that vanilla is better than chocolate. That's subjectively true. It's my preference. Do you see the difference? It's objectively true that I happen to like it more. But it's not objectively true that it is better. That's a matter of preference. It's objectively true that it's wrong to own people. It's objectively true, regardless of opinion. It's wrong today, and it was wrong when it wasn't illegal in this country. When everybody thought it was okay to own people, it was still wrong, because it does not depend on human opinion. If it does depend on human opinion, it's by definition subjectively true. Now, this is the question you have to ask. Can we have intrinsic, objective value if we are the measure of all things? If the last word in value and morality is us, isn't that just subjectively true? Because one set of people can say, those people are less than me because they have more melanin in their skin. Or those people happen to live in this area and I don't like them and we have more guns and therefore they will serve us. We have never been more educated than we are right now. Slavery is far more prevalent in the world today than it's ever been. There are more slaves today than ever in the world. And we've never had more technology and all these things. So you can see a growing problem here on the idea of how can we really justify these things without God. But as I begin to talk about this, I want to tell you a story. It's a true story about an encounter I had with a friend. This friend and I were actually in school together. He was an agnostic, really kind of an atheist, and I was a Muslim at the time. We never really discussed religion, though, very in-depth at least. Everybody else and I had talks about religion, but not this guy. Not totally sure why, because it wasn't like he was antagonistic towards it. We just never went there. Not totally sure why, but we went to school, graduated, went our separate ways, and then he got the subtle hint that I became a Christian because he was at my wedding at a church and I took communion. So he's like, I think something changed. But you know how weddings are. You can never actually get into in-depth conversations, especially when you're the groom. All you do is say, thanks for coming, and then walk on to the next person and tell them the same exact thing. You don't remember your dessert. I barely remember the toast. And I thank goodness for video, because otherwise I wouldn't remember my wedding at all. I actually do remember the ceremony. I just don't remember the reception very well, because it's just a blur, you know, when you go through these things and through them. Well, he was there, but I didn't get to talk to him very much in detail. Well, a couple years later, he happened to be visiting. He was in the city of Detroit. He was visiting, doing some business. And he said, hey, I'm in town. I'd love to be able to take you out to dinner. Let's go somewhere really fancy because it's a business expense. I said, great. If you pay, I'll pray. So he paid. We went to a really nice place, actually. Had a great time catching up on, you know, life, other things, career, how they were going, family, kids, you know, just that stuff. But eventually things turned spiritual because he wanted to know. So I got to ask you, how did that happen? What's the deal? You got a book out. My first book was written at the time. You're involved in Christian ministry. What happened? How'd that go? So I told him the story I basically told you yesterday, and then went into some other things about philosophy, about the problem of suffering and evil and all these things. A lot of philosophy and just discussions on these things. Well, he said, okay, that's great. Here's my question, though. I really have a hard time believing that this God that you believe in is so good and all-powerful because of all the suffering and the evil in the world. I mean, really, if God was powerful, he could stop all the evil and suffering. If he was good, he would want to stop all the evil and suffering, but we have evil and suffering, so either he can't stop it or he's not good. And he won't stop it. Better yet, maybe he doesn't exist at all. Now, he asked me that not in a gotcha kind of a way. He actually wanted to know if there was an answer to this. He's curious about it. So we're talking philosophically, and I said, okay, look, I'll give you some philosophical answers. And I gave him some philosophical answers, some biblical answers as well. And it was very sort of abstract and esoteric in our discussion. The good news is this. Everyone, by the way, in this room has asked that question. You've either asked it when you've heard of some tragedy, the tsunami that happened in Japan just a few years ago, an earthquake that happened in Japan just 2 days ago, when the shootings happened, when the Newtown thing happened. You all ask yourself, if you're a human being, for heaven's sake, you ask why and how. Can that be true? Or if you've never had any sort of hitch in your faith, you've also wondered, tomorrow when I go to work and someone says, how can God let this happen? Or how can there be a God when all this is happening? You want to know, how do I respond? It's the question that stalks all of us. It stalks all of us. So he asked this question. I gave him five philosophical answers. The good news is, logically speaking, this has been debunked a long time ago. No real serious philosophers, whether atheist or theist, actually tell you that this is the logical problem with God and evil. There might be an emotional problem with it, or what's called the existential problem of evil, but there's no real logical problem anymore. So I gave him some of those answers. The last one I parked on, well, I'll give you one before I move on. I said, you know, what you've said actually is that it's objectively wrong for people to suffer. He said, right. I said, good, okay, so it's wrong. So you believe in objective morality, that morals actually exist independent of human opinion. He said, well, sure, I guess. So if it's wrong for human beings to suffer, that means there's an inherent evil in the world. If there's an inherent evil, there's also an inherent good, isn't there? Now, if there's an inherent evil and an inherent good, there's got to be a way to differentiate between those two things, an objective moral law that tells you what's good and what's evil independent of your opinion. Do you agree? He said, so far. I said, great. If there's an objective moral law, it's got to be beyond human opinion. But there's nothing beyond humans. Where does it come from? In order to have that objective moral law, you have to have an objective moral law giver. So if morals are real, and they are, and they're personal qualities, you know, goodness isn't good. No one says, oh, look how just justice is being. No one says, oh, I'm so thankful that kindness is being so kind today. Things aren't kind. Persons are kind. So if those moral values actually have a basis, they have a basis in an objective framework, and they have to have a personal basis. So what sounds like an objective, transcendent, personal source for morals? God. So rather than disprove God's existence, suffering and evil actually proves it. He's like, I don't know about that, and we went back and forth a little bit. I said, well, one of the last things I want to tell you is this, is that if God exists, then he's a being who knows all future things, all future actual things, and all future possible things. In other words, God knows what would have happened if you chose not to come here today. He knows what would have happened. He knows what did happen. You came here today. But he also knows what's called a counterfactual in philosophy, that what would have happened. So if God knows the spiderweb of history, both a previous and future history, then that means that he could have a knowledge that we don't have, that he could allow certain sufferings and evils to happen in this world. He doesn't cause them, but he could allow them for a greater possible good that you won't see. You won't see it 5 minutes from now or 50,000 years from now. Maybe you will, maybe you won't, but you are not in a position to say that you know. He said, oh, no, absolutely not. That tsunami that happened in 2004 in the Indian Ocean, there's no way a greater possible good can come from that. I said, well, wait a minute. Are you telling me that you know all the future? And he says, well, no. I said, good, because if you were saying you know all the future, then congratulations, you're God. And you're trying to use your knowledge of the future to tell me that there's no being who knows the future. So we got the point. He said, okay, fine. God could allow, if he exists at all, God could allow suffering for some greater possible good. But here's my question. And it changed. Not in the content, but in the tone. He said, I want to know how this God you claim to believe in could love me or my mother or value me or my mother when he let her die of cancer when I was 10. He called that a life-shaping moment. It's the same question, logically. It's a far different question, existentially, in terms of its relevance to him. And I could tell from the pathos of the way he asked the question that this wasn't a question his atheism had answered for him in 28 years. His mom died when he was 10. 28 years later, he's asking me the question with the same, I wouldn't say anger, but with a passion that suggested he had not found an answer and was hoping he could find one. So how do you answer? What do you do? Do you give him more syllogisms and more argument and more philosophy? That might do more violence to the situation. What do you do? Well, put a pin in it because I want to come back to it. These four main questions. How do we get here? Why are we here? Why is the human condition the way it is? And is there a way out of this mess? All those four questions impact how my friend sees himself and humans as well. So I want to go through those real quickly for you and see how I think the secular humanist answers try their hardest but just don't get you there and lead you to this kind of a question. So what's the first question? How do we get here? Is there a God or how do we get here? Well, on the secular humanist framework, there is no God. There is no supernatural. There's either the natural world or merely the physical world. But secular humanists don't believe in the supernatural. So how do we get here? We're here by a quirk of chance that the physical forces of the universe happen to align in a certain way, and inevitably, through time plus matter plus chance and all these different things, we have a universe that comes together, and it happens to be that life is here. When Richard Dawkins, the world's most famous atheist, was actually describing the state of affairs in the universe and human condition, what he says is this, pardon me, if the universe were just electrons and selfish genes, meaningless tragedies are exactly what we should expect along with equally meaningless good fortune. Put a pin in that. It's a longer quote here, but understand this. When my friend asks about his mother's suffering, Dawkins, in an honest moment, will have to tell him, objectively, it was meaningless. Her death meant nothing. Can you ever think of sadder words than he or she died for no reason? Meaningless tragedies are exactly what we should expect, along with equally meaningless good fortune. Such a universe would be neither evil nor good in intention. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no good, no evil, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. If there's no God, he's not wrong. When pressed further to ask what are we? As human beings, he gives an even bleaker response because we go into the idea of why we're here. Because if we're here by chance, he's not wrong. Then you ask the second question, why are we here? If you think we're here by accident, then there is no objective why, just the why you give yourself. Listen to the words of Stephen Jay Gould, the late paleontologist and evolutionary biologist out of Harvard University, a brilliant man who was asked the question, why are we here? This is what he says. We are here because one odd group of fishes had a peculiar fin anatomy that could transform into legs for terrestrial creatures. Because comets struck the Earth and wiped out dinosaurs, thereby giving mammals a chance not otherwise available. So thank your lucky stars in a literal sense. He was a funny guy. Because the Earth never froze entirely during an ice age. Because a small and tenuous species arising in Africa 250,000 years ago has managed so far to survive by hook and by crook. We may yearn for a higher answer, he says, but none exists. This explanation, though superficially troubling, if not terrifying, is ultimately liberating and exhilarating. We cannot read the meaning of life passively into the facts of nature. We must make these answers ourselves. Through our own wisdom and ethical sense, he says, there is no other way. Do you see what he's saying? He's saying meaning and morality and all these things are in our hands, and that's exhilarating, though superficially troubling and terrifying. Have you ever been superficially terrified? I think there's a clue there. I think Stephen Jay Gould recognized back when he was alive that there is something terrifying about the idea that there is no objective purpose. We're the ones who determine it, because the history of the human race has shown we're not very good at that. So it's superficially troubling, if not terrifying, but there is no other way. We have to do it ourselves. Purpose is subjective. He just admitted it. When asked what the point of human existence is, Dawkins, who's a little more harsh, I think, than Stephen Jay Gould, said, and I quote, "We are machines for propagating DNA. It is every living object's sole reason for living." You're a DNA machine. Now let me ask you, as handsome a crowd as you guys are, you all got up in the morning, you coiffed your hair, shaved, brushed your teeth, got dressed, snapped your collar, and thought, "I am a snappily dressed DNA machine." You probably didn't do that. Now, some might say, well, evolution has taught you this lie that you're actually valuable so that we survive as a species. Others might say, when you look at a baby, you ever held a baby whose cheeks are so big that their eyes are an afterthought? And you think to yourself, this is a really cute, adorable DNA propagator? Probably didn't think that. There's something more to this baby, more to you. You inherently know it. Something more to it than that. But that's what secular humanism has to say. Now, they want to value human life. They want to value it. And I understand that, and I get it. But the reality is that ultimately there is a subservience to the greater sort of gene pool of natural selection. Natural selection does not care about the propagation of the human species. It just cares. It doesn't care at all, actually. It's a mindless, blind, pitiless, indifferent mechanism by which certain molecules get foisted into the next generation of molecules. And you are part of the machine. Eventually, you're going to die, and your molecules will become part of the earth, and then other animals will use your molecules to create themselves and their progeny, and all of it will keep going, and all of it will die a heat death. If you look at the laws of entropy and thermodynamics, you understand the universe is losing energy in terms of its dissipation. It's not losing it in terms of its destruction, but ultimately the universe's energy, active energy, will be used up, and it'll become a flat, featureless disk, absent some kind of supernatural, you know, upholding of the universe. So all of it is pointless. Ultimately, you can help somebody, but they'll die eventually, and then they'll die. Whoever they help will die eventually, and then it'll all just become pointless anyway. It's all temporary. So what explains the human condition? How we got here? Chance and physical forces. Why are we here? There is no really why. Why is the human condition the way it is? Ultimately, they'll tell you this. Why is there suffering and there evil? Objectively speaking, it's not bad. It just is. Some are going to get lucky. Some are going to get hurt. Quoting Dawkins again. Natural selection, by definition, by the way, natural selection is that the stronger of the species will dominate the weaker of the species. That's how it works. And therefore, the genes and through mutations and various things, those who have adaptability will get the food or the resources better. They'll survive the cataclysms better than the weaker, and those stronger genes will project into the next generation. Nature is red in tooth and claw, as Alfred Lord Tennyson said, and that's just kind of how it is. And that's that way with us as well. Darwin actually lamented the idea. He said, you know, there's a problem here. If my worldview is correct, if my theory about evolution is correct, there's something we have to wrestle with as human beings. We are the only species that takes care of its sick, it's injured, and it's insane. And every other species, either they get better or they die out. We're the only ones that will let their genetic material go into the next generation. We're the only ones who do that. Now, why? He doesn't know, but we're the ones who do that. But there's chance. People get lucky or get hurt based on chance. There's a survival of the fittest issue. There's also competing resources and a lack of education. And if we just educate ourselves enough and spread the wealth and have more iPods and whatever it is, we'll eventually sort of have like a Star Trek-like existence where everyone will be fine. We'll get there eventually. If man is a measure of all things, we'll get there eventually. As long as we don't blow ourselves up first, we'll get there. Of course, I think that there is a serious historical problem with this. But then is there a salvation or a solution to the human condition? Now, of course, atheists don't believe in a salvation of any kind because there's nothing after this. Your life, this is all that matters. This life is all there is. When you die, it's done. It's just a lack of no more existence after this. But is there a better way out of this? Yes, through successive education and a sort of a shared moral value, we'll eventually come to rough agreement on various things, and we'll get better and better as a society. And we'll get there, and we'll get there. Some say we're on our way, that things are getting better despite all the evidence of the contrary. Things are actually getting better in the world. Others, like John Gray, the atheist John Gray, will say, no, we're not getting better. We are getting far worse. We are the worst animals that exist because other animals don't have the capacity to destroy themselves. They naturally come to a state of equilibrium. Human beings have the insatiable desire to destroy not only themselves, but everything around them. He doesn't call us Homo sapiens. This is an atheist talking. He calls us Homo rapiens because we rape the natural world. And we're eventually going to lead to our own destruction. But it's interesting because the Humanist Manifesto actually talks about the inherent good and the ability of humanity to actually get us to a higher state. I was talking to somebody who is an ordained secular humanist minister, which I find fascinating. But he's an ordained minister. He can do secular humanist weddings and funerals and these kind of things. and I happen to see his plaque, so I know he's ordained. So we were having a conversation, a very thoughtful guy. I really love him. We have great conversations, very, very bright. And I said, what's your chief hang-up with Christianity? He said, oh, that's easy. Like, oh, do tell. He said, arrogance. The problem with Christians is they're arrogant. He says, not you, Abdu. I said, oh, thank you for accepting me from the whole of Christendom. What I mean by that is Christianity says that it's the only way to God and that everyone else is wrong and you guys are special because you have the truth and everyone else is going to hell. That seems to me to be the height of arrogance. And you, and a lot of judgmental, you know, attitudes. That's interesting. Judgmental attitudes is a bad thing. You just judge 2 billion people for being that way. So you just judgmentally judge people for being judgmental? And he saw the point and I said, but let me point out something. You're saying that Christianity is arrogant because it makes an exclusive claim to truth. And that's wrong, and it's arrogant to do that. You're an ordained secular humanist minister. He said, right. So do you agree with the Secular Humanist Manifesto 3? He said, matter of fact, I do. I said, good, I have part of it memorized. So do you agree when it says human beings have the ability and responsibility to lead ethical lives of personal fulfillment that aspire to the greater good of all? He said, yeah. I said, great. So you have, as a human being, you have the ability and responsibility to lead an ethical life of personal fulfillment that aspires to the greater good of all. You can help to save the world. He said, oh, absolutely. I had that ability, and so do you, Abdu. I said, great. So that ability is in you, just so I'm clear? He said, yep. I said, great. As a Christian, I believe that I'm a sinner and you're a sinner. I believe that there is a spark of good, there's an imago Dei, there's an image of God in us, but ultimately we do self-seek. We seek our own way before we seek someone else's benefit. Ultimately, that I'm a sinner, my kids are sinners, everyone's a sinner, that we need a Savior who's not us to save us from us. Now, I believe in a Savior who's not me, but you believe in you, who's arrogant. The point is this, is that we have this desire, and all of us do, to say that we can better humanity, and I believe we have to make that decision to try. When Ryan comes, he's going to talk about a defense of marriage and life and all these things. Why? Not because he thinks we should all just chuck it and wait for Jesus to come back. We're waiting for that. But he's saying we have a responsibility as stewards of the planet and stewards of life to try to work for the greater good of humanity. I agree with that. But if we think that the ability to do that rests in us and only us, we are immensely arrogant. And history has shown our inability to do that. So how do we get here? Chance. Why are we here? There is no real why other than the one you create. What explains the human condition? Again, in some senses, chance and lack of education in these things. And how do we get out of this mess? We'll just figure it out. You know, we'll just figure it out. But then you look and see what the Christian response is to all these things. The first thing is this. I think as a Christian, you have to affirm something you have in common with your atheist friend, with your secular humanist friend, that they have a desire, a good desire, a valuable desire, to uphold the value of human life. Now, sometimes it doesn't always happen, because you do have folks, Alberto Giubilini and Francesca Minerva, for example, two medical ethicists out of Australia, wrote an article called Why Should the Baby Live?, where they make the case for post-birth abortion, that people can actually kill their children up to a certain age because the child can't value itself. It has no cognitive ability to value itself. So it only has value if those who have that ability give it value. So if the mother and the father give it value, then it shouldn't be killed. But if the mother and the father don't give it value, then why not? Peter Singer out of Princeton University, who is the chair, I think, of bioethics there, brilliant man, has the exact same opinion. So this is not in a vacuum, friends. How does the Christian worldview, though, take the majority of us who actually think, whether they're Christian or not, human beings have inherent value and say, that's the right position. Absolutely, I'm with you in that. We're standing together in this. I'm against racism. I'm against phobias and whatever else we want to call these things of all kinds where we just denigrate somebody because of their views. We can disagree without insulting people's essential worth. How do we do that, affirm that, but then offer them the gospel as the foundation for why that's true? Four questions. Is there a God and how do we get here? Of course, as a Christian, we believe very, very vehemently that there is a God, that God specially created us. You know, in Romans, time and again, Paul says specifically that when you look to the natural order, when you look outside and you see the way the trees and the surrounding environment interacts, all these things, you see evidence for God's handiwork. And the psalmist, thousands of years before Paul, said, when I gaze at the stars and I look at the works of your hands, I'm in awe and wonder of you. And what is man that you are mindful of him? So you see the universe and you see humanity. And science is proving to us again and again that there's something about us that's incredibly, incredibly special. You know, when you look to the universe, and scientists will tell you there's a thing called fine-tuning. The fine-tuning of the universe is not a theologically loaded term. Atheists and Christians who happen to be scientists will tell you that the universe does appear to be finely tuned for the existence of life. What that means basically is this. There are between 40 and 80 properties, actually more, the trend is getting more and more, of the universe where if they were off by even an infinitesimal degree, no life is possible at all. If any one of them is off by an infinitesimal degree, the organizational state of the universe at its inception, the expansion rate of the universe, the subatomic weak forces that are not only in atoms, but also in between the subatomic particles themselves, the cosmological constant, the gravitational constants, if any one of these are different by a hair's breadth, and when I say that, that's not even really a good example of this. If you were to understand how finely tuned some of these things are, imagine. This is back in the days when a radio dial wasn't digital, when you actually had the little red thing that moved along it. So put that in your mind, okay? Imagine you had one of those that has the stations with the same spacing you have in your car or had in your car before the digital sort of revolution on this stuff. You know, about a millimeter or 2 millimeters different of space. Imagine that. But imagine that dial with that many stations on it, that spacing, that is as wide as the universe itself, okay? Billions and billions of light years across. And you have to, at random, tune it to exactly the right station. With blindfolded. And you get one chance. That's what it's like to have any one of these properties tuned so that life could exist. It was Frederick Hoyle, the atheist, who said, it looks like someone's been monkeying with the physics. Now, some will say it appears designed. Others say if it appears designed, then maybe it is designed. That's from the universe. Then you look inside you and me at the DNA molecule. The DNA molecule, 3.1 billion bits of information. I want you to read this statement. Listen to this statement from Francis Collins. Francis Collins is a believer. He is the co-mapper of the human genome and the director of the National Institutes of Health. He says, this newly revealed text of the DNA molecule was 3 billion letters long and written in a strange and cryptographic four-letter code. Such is the amazing complexity of the information carried within each cell of the human body that a live reading of that code, of the one DNA strand, at a rate of 3 letters per second would take 31 years, even if you read constantly day and night. Printing these letters out in regular font size on normal bond paper and binding them all together would result in a tower the height of the Washington Monument. For the first time on that summer morning, this amazing script, carrying within it all the instruction for building a human being, was available to the world. 3 billion bits of information in one DNA strand in your body, and you have trillions of them, and yours is different than mine. There are 7 billion people on the planet, and they're all different, except for twins. And even they have slight variations. Remarkable. Now, whenever you see information like that, one DNA strand has more information than the graduate library at the University of Michigan. And it's got 7 floors full of books. One DNA strand has more information than that. Now, in nature, whenever we see complex information, not just information, but complex information that serves a purpose, that's got functional specificity, every time, without exception, whenever we see that, we see intelligence behind it. You see a book like that, you see a piece of paper like that, you see a program code like that, you always know there's a programmer. Every time. Yet this is the one instance, the most complex information in the history of the world, and this one is chance? Or is there something more? Is it screaming out for a designer? Now, what's interesting about this, friends, is that this actually informs us not only of how we got here, but why we're here. Why we're here. You see, the Psalms don't say you were built. They don't say you were designed, even. They do say that you were fashioned, and there was something about you that was fashioned. But it's more than that. It's better than that. See, God is an engineer, but he's also a poet. He's a poetic engineer. He's a painter. He's a sculptor. He's all these things. When you look at the Psalms, what does it say about how you and I were put together? You know, I have a lot of sweaters. I'm from Michigan. And some of them were gifts from family, so they have sentimental value. Others I just bought because I needed to be warm, so they have monetary value. But every one of those sweaters were all made in a factory by design at a template. And there's 1,000 just like them. And they're nice. I have one sweater in my home that is utterly useless to me, and it's my most valuable sweater. It won't even fit on my right hand anymore. It is this little purple sweater my mother knit to bring me home in the hospital when I was born. I brought my Lyell home in that sweater, my son Yusuf, and my daughter Nadia. All my kids came home from the hospital in that very same sweater. Why is it valuable to me? Because my mom used a template. There was a design, but when she knit it, when she did the cross, stitch, loop, whatever knitters do when they knit, when she was doing that, she thought, my boy, Abdu, my son, my boy, his kids, one day. Every knitting. Psalm 139 says, you knit me together in my mother's womb. Do you see that? There's design, and there's that engineering aspect to it. There's also that incredibly intimate motherly aspect to it. It's that you weren't accidentally created or even on an assembly line created. You were knit together in your mother's womb. So why are we here? This is the question everyone always asks. Why are we here? Why? What's the meaning of life? Whenever you see someone asking this question in the media, whether it's through a television show or a movie, what is the scenario typically? It's this guy who wants to go on a quest. You know, it's Forrest Gump running across America, and his beard gets long, and he gets these followers, and they don't know what they're doing, and neither does he, apparently. And he just runs back and forth, and he tries to find out the meaning of life. What's the answer? What's the answer? Or the guy who's getting up to the top of the mountain, and now his beard is super long, and his clothes are tattered, and he gets to the top of the mountain, and there sits the guy in the lotus position chanting something. He has eyebrows that won't quit, and he asks the guy the question, says, what is the meaning of life? And as the guy opens his mouth to answer, cut to commercial. Because no one knows the answer, right? It's the hardest question in the world. And I travel a lot for ministry, obviously, and I have a hard time working in total silence. So, and here's why. I have 3 kids. And when I work at home, and it's absolutely silent in the house, and the kids are in the house, that's a bad thing. Something happened. Someone got knocked unconscious, and no one's telling you who did it. So I get distracted by silences. So I was in a hotel, and I was trying to get some work done, and I needed some background noise, and so I turned on the television to find something that would just be background noise. And I didn't want it to be distracted by enough to watch it, but I failed at that one because I ended up watching this program that I found. It's Everyone Loves Raymond. You ever hear this about this show? So the premise of the show is that there's this dad, Raymond, who's a well-meaning guy, kind of a bumbler, screws things up, but eventually fixes it by the end of the show. By half an hour later, he fixes it, he becomes dad of the year. Well, his daughter asked him a question. Where do people come from? And now he's got to have, you know, the talk with her, and he's terrified, and he makes a comment about storks or something, bringing babies. And so his wife's like, Ray, you can't tell her that, because she's going to find out the truth from her friends. very, very soon, and then not trust us with the big questions of life. Go tell her the truth. So for a half an hour, he tries to figure out how to have the talk with her without embarrassing himself. So he finally gets his courage ready to go, walks up to her room. There she is playing with her dolls at the end of the bed, sits down next to her and says, "Honey, you asked Daddy a very important question about where babies come from. Well, you see, when a man and a woman come together and they're married," and she goes, "Whoa, whoa, stop, stop, stop. I already know that. I want to know, why does God put us here?" The meaning of life question. No one knows the answer, right? So now he's even more flummoxed, and he says, God puts us here because heaven is crowded. And the reason why that's funny is because no one knows the meaning of life question. Simple. Quite simple. Straightforward. Westminster Shorter Confession says, the chief end of man is to glorify God and delight in his presence forever. Very easy. Do you hear it? The chief end of man is to glorify God because he's the one who knit you together in that glorious DNA that you and I could never fathom could come together by chance. You glorify God for that, and he does that so that you can delight in his presence forever. Yesterday we talked about this, about the desire for human relationship, is that we are created for relationship with the being who defines it, a triune being. What explains why you and I want relationship so badly? I said it yesterday, and I'll say it again. Why you and I want it, covet it, or miss it when it's gone so much is that we have a cause who defines relationship. The Father, Son, Holy Spirit, one God existing in a triune state, defines relationship for us, and so that's why you and I want it so badly. Does a blind, pitiless, indifferent universe adequately explain why you are not blind, pitiless, or indifferent? You're better than that? You're better than the cause? That seems to go against the stream of thought. That which caused you ought to be higher than you. And chance doesn't love anybody. But you do. Because there's something about you and about me that desires relationship, because the cause himself is relationship. What accounts for the human condition? And that is that sin. It is that violation of that purpose. We're created for that purpose, and we have decided to break from it. And this denial of human sinfulness and this desire to say that we're all great and we're all grand, you know, all religions are fundamentally different. They are. People say, oh, they're fundamentally the same. No, they're not. They're not. They're superficially the same. On the surface, they're the same. They teach love and goodness and all these things. It reminds me of the Steve Turner quote. Have you ever heard Steve Turner's satire called The Creed on the Spirit of the Age? He says, all religions teach basically the same thing. At least the ones we read do. They all teach love and goodness. They only differ on matters of heaven, hell, God, sin, and salvation. All paths don't lead to God. In fact, all paths don't even claim to. The Buddhist doesn't claim to go to God. The Buddhist claims to become nothing. That's the goal, to become nothing. An atheist says there is no God. In Islam, you don't get to be with God. You get to go to God's paradise. In Christianity, you get to be with God. They're different. And we respect them by pointing out the differences. But here's where they're similar. They're all similar this way. All of them tell you that you can fix you. That there's a human condition that can be fixed by humans. To some degree, whether it's follow the law well enough or engineer a better life through your education, whatever it might be, they're all fundamentally similar in that way. Christianity is specifically different. Because Jesus says in Matthew 15, verse 19, out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false testimony, and slander. That is a terrible recruiting poster. I mean, think about this. Would you want, if you want to get followers, come follow me. What would you tell them? You can do it. Follow the law and do this and you can be justified. Or would you tell them, you have an inner God inside of you and you can just wait, like Deepak Chopra says, and just nurture the seeds of divinity and you can become your own powerful being. Man, that's a good recruiting poster. Sign me up for that, so to speak, because I get to justify myself, whatever it might be. You're evil. Come follow me? How does that get any followers? But it does. Here's why. I love Jesus for many reasons, one of which is this. He is not trying to sell you a bill of goods. He's not telling you what you want to hear. What you want to hear is how great you are. What you need to hear is how great you're not. And he tells it like it is. Not interested in popularity, very interested in truth. Then offers you the salvation that comes from it. And this denial of human evil results in some very bad things. but also the recognition of it sometimes can change even the hardest of hearts. I want to read from you a quote. It's a long quote, so bear with me, but I want you to read the depth of this quote by a man named C.E.M. Jode. C.E.M. Jode, writing in the early 20th century, was talking about how his atheism and his socialism and his secularism had failed because it failed to see the reality of human evil. Listen to his words. It's a long quote, but bear with me. It's worth listening to. He says, "To reject the doctrine of original sin, as so many of those whose outlook was formed in the atmosphere of left-wing politics and rationalistic philosophy rejected it, was to fall victim to a shallow optimism in regard to human nature, which led men to think that the millennium was just around the corner, waiting to be introduced by a society of adequately psychoanalyzed, prosperous socialists. It is because we rejected the doctrine of original sin that we on the left were always being disappointed. Disappointed by the refusal of people to be reasonable, by the subservience of intellect to emotion, by the failure of true socialism to arrive, by the behavior of nations and politicians, by the preference of the masses to Hollywood over Shakespeare and for Mr. Sinatra over Beethoven, above all, by the recurrent fact of war. To believe as I have grown to believe, listen to this carefully now, in the fundamental and in this life ineradicable nature of human sinfulness is intolerable, unless there is some source of guidance and assistance outside of ourselves to which we can turn for comfort and assurance. Presently, the fact of sin and evil came to present themselves with such overwhelming strength that unless one were able to seek assistance, if not for the overcoming of it, then at least for the not succumbing to it, one would give way to despair. The more I knew of it, this original sin, the sin inherent of us, the more Christianity seemed to offer just the strengthening and assistance that I needed. And with that, the rationalist, optimist philosophy, by the light of which I had hitherto done my best to live, came to seem intolerably trivial and superficial. A shallow-rooted plant, which growing to maturity amid the lush and leisured optimism of the 19th century, was quite unfitted to withstand the bleaker winds that blew through ours. I abandoned it, and in abandoning it, found myself a Christian." Hear what he's saying? To deny human sinfulness is to deny reality. And to be continually disappointed, and then to yield to despair once you do recognize it, because there's no way out of this mess unless you recognize there's something outside of us that can save us. And he found it in the gospel. What explains the human condition? Humans do. But is there an answer? And of course the answer is yes. There is an answer. Is there a better life? You know, we look for answers all the time, and we look for them in ourselves or in the stars or whatever it might be. But really, the answers have been there all along. Paul says in Acts chapter 17 that God has put every man where they ought to be, every person where they ought to be, where they should live. He's determined this so they may look and search for him, though he's not far from any one of them. The answers are there for all of us. But if we're the problem, we can't be the solution. We need a Savior who's not us to save us from ourselves. And that's where the cross comes in. That's where it comes in, is that it provides that remedy to us. It provides that heart transplant we need. Not a treadmill, but a heart transplant. So we can fix our condition. The debt that we owed is paid for at the cross. So let me return back to my friend, and then we'll close. And then we'll have another session. We'll have a short break, right, Dick? And then we'll have the next session, and I'll have Q&A after that. My friend asked me the question. Remember what his question was? How can I know that this God is good and values me or my mother if he let her die of cancer when I was 10? That's quite the question. Life-shaping moment. Yeah, I would think so. So I prayed real quick, swallowed hard, and asked God for something that would allow me to touch his mind and his heart, a logically consistent answer that would also matter to him existentially. Because the philosophical rubber had met the existential road, my friends. In a hurry. So I said, look, you know, I've lost people in my life, and I've had my share of pain, but I never lost someone so close to me when I was so young. Never happened to me. I can't imagine what that's like for a 10-year-old to go through something like that. But can I tell you something? We've been discussing something for a long time now, and I said that God could allow suffering for a greater possible good, and you agreed, and he said, yeah. Waiting for me to make an argument out of his mother's death. I wasn't going to do that. I said, you agreed, and it's a nice theory. It's a philosophical theory. It's nice. I could tell you that. A Muslim could tell you the same thing. God could allow suffering for a greater possible good because he knows all things, and that's possible. A Jew could tell you that. A Hindu could tell you that. Even certain strains of Buddhism can tell you that. And it's a nice theory. But can I offer something to you? Why uniquely, as a Christian, I have something more than theory? That God could allow suffering for a greater possible good? I have the history that he actually did it. He allowed his own son to undergo unspeakable suffering, not for some theoretical good that might happen, but for an actual good that did happen, the salvation of the world. The resurrection proves it happened. The historical resurrection, beyond hope, is knowledge of the historical fact. You asked me one other question I said. You asked me, how can I know that this God not only is good, but values me or my mother? And how do you know anything is valuable? How do you know what something's worth? You know, I got a lot of things in my home. I got my wedding video, thank goodness, because I don't remember it. I said, the ceremony I do remember. For the record, I remember the ceremony. But my kids' first steps, their first birthdays, milestones in their life, all recorded on photo or film or whatever, or video. If there's a fire in my home, those things will all burn and melt. And I will not risk my life for them. I will mourn their loss because they're valuable, but I will not put my kids' parents' life at risk for that stuff. But I'll tell you what, if one of my kids or my wife is in that home, you better believe I'm going back in that house. I'll risk being burned alive, being disfigured, or dying of smoke inhalation to save their life. You know how valuable something is by how much you're willing to pay for it. And my friend, you can know. You have immeasurable value. Objectively, no. You have immeasurable value, and so did your mother, because the immeasurable God paid an immeasurable price to spend an immeasurable eternity with you and with her. He offered that to her, and he offers that to you now. He looked at me, and he said, "Now that is worth thinking about." Friends, I think that the cross, honestly, no matter what central question you have, whether it's the suffering issue, whether it's the human value issue, whether it's the how great can our God be issue, the cross is the answer. Because for the Muslim, God's greatness, I think, can be given to them by showing that the greatest possible being expresses the greatest possible ethic in the greatest possible way, and that's self-sacrifice. For the humanist who wants to know our human value, your value is proven by the fact that you are paid for. You are known. Your value is demonstrated objectively so, and pain is gone. The cross is the answer. It really is. So hopefully that gives you something to think about. God bless you guys. Thank you.